From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we talk with the City of Milwaukee's outgoing Commissioner of Health, Jeanette Kowalik, about the challenges she faced on the job. Then we look at the history of public mental health funding and what it looks like today.
In the 1780s, 1790s, people were frequently treated in jails. We're back to that. The three largest mental health providers in the United States are Rikers Island, Los Angeles County Jail, and the Cook County Jail.
Plus, we learn about plans for the Milwaukee Public Museum and Betty Brin Children's Museum to co-locate under a new roof.
We're very excited about this opportunity because while we do have a unique location, beautiful location here on the lakefront, we're in a space that was never designed to be a children's museum that's really smaller than we would like it to be.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This week marked the end of Jeanette Kowalik's tenure as the City of Milwaukee's Commissioner of Health. Kowalik, a Milwaukee native, took the job in 2018 after former Commissioner Bevin Baker resigned amid the city's lead crisis scandal. After 2 years on the job, Kowalik has accepted a position with a health policy organization in Washington, D.C. Not long after her resignation was announced, the Daily Beast published an opinion piece by Kowalik that outlined the difficulties she faced as the leader of the city's health department. Kowalik says she faced racism, sexism, battled misinformation about COVID-19, and budgetary challenges in addressing the pandemic. Kowalik sat down for a socially distanced conversation with WUWM Susan Bentz to talk about the difficulties she encountered on the job and what's next for the city's health department. She starts by describing the reaction she received to her opinion piece in the Daily Beast.
Many of my colleagues and just random people in our community have been reaching out to me in support and thanking me for being vocal and honest about what I've experienced in the last 2 years in this position. As a Black woman in leadership, I know that this is not uncommon, unfortunately. I've had colleagues that also acknowledged that they were receiving threats of harm, that they were constantly having to prove that they were qualified for their jobs and not being fetishized or treated as if they're only able to do certain types of work because of their look or their who they are. So again, as a Black woman, being the commissioner, obviously that's the role that I had, but always having to validate and prove that I'm qualified and worthy of doing the job. That wears on you because you think about, if I wasn't qualified, then why did I get the job? And you know, there's these talks about imposter syndrome and all of these things. And when you also start thinking about other types of discrimination, and I mentioned this before, that sometimes people, when they think of being attacked, you know, racist attacks or sexist attacks, they always think of like the worst thing possible. And from my perspective, I'm looking at a whole spectrum of offenses, from the very small ones, from the microaggressions to more overt things that have been said to me, and all of that. So it's very concerning to me because I don't want others to be discouraged from moving into these positions, but I do want to put people on notice, the people that are allowing these types of environments, that it's, we're going to continue to lose people because we also have a number of concerns of being safe and being able to focus on our jobs. We shouldn't have to worry about being harassed in a variety of manners. And I understand some men do that because they don't know how to process you. You know, they want to minimize you because you're a beautiful person or whatever, that you can possibly be intelligent. And that's, you know, it's, again, it wears on you. It's like death by a thousand paper cuts. So I just want to continue to encourage other women, other Black women, other women of color, other queer women, and move into these spaces because we need to lead and our voices need to be heard. And I said this also, we had a talk in Cleveland about how we declare racism as a public health crisis. And I said, you can't be afraid to get fired. And that was my real mentality in this job, because I was so tired and weary. I was like, go ahead and fire me. Do me a favor. But I'm going to try to live and lead as fully as possible until I can't do it anymore. Obviously, the pandemic accelerated that. Just the level of stress and sacrifice was just magnified by 1,000. And I, you know, was able to at least do some things in this world to really protect our community, save lives. I'm thankful I was still able to do orders for the city of Milwaukee. But the long game is what needs to be focused on right now. So again, me moving back to DC, able to do national public health policy work with an equity lens, I'll be able to help give back to those that are on the front lines back here at home and everywhere else across the country.
So at a recent steering and rules committee meeting, Alderwoman Dmitrievich posed the question, how can the city of Milwaukee make sure that what has happened to you and others doesn't happen again, and that the city is able to attract and keep a diverse, talented pool of people to diversify and strengthen the city?
Part of creating an environment of inclusion and diversity is to prepare for it. You know, you can't just recruit and hire people from different backgrounds and think that that's going to fix the problem. There needs to be some preparation to be able to receive and support people like me in these positions. I know the city is committed to working on our own house, so the racism as a public health crisis declaration. There's a number of action items that are tied to that. Those action items were just getting going and then COVID hit. So I think we have to figure out a way to prioritize completing those to-do items, those 5 to-do items, the needs assessment, the recommendation report from the Equal Rights Commission, looking at hiring practices, professional development needs related to anti-racism work, looking at the policies and practices within each city department, and then helping other communities to declare racism as a public health crisis. There also needs to be some focus on the housing element. That was not included in our order or our ordinance, but it needs to be included in future ones, because we know that housing is health, and you can't even move into self-actualization if you don't have a safe place to sleep and stay. So, again, that's pretty much the longer answer, but putting the racism as a public health crisis into action that needs to happen ASAP.
So you returned to your hometown of Milwaukee to help the health department recover from a really tough spot, in particular the condition of its childhood lead poisoning prevention program. So how would you assess that program, the progress made over your tenure?
The childhood lead poisoning prevention program was the reason why the vacancy existed, right? So there was a lot of work that needed to be done. And some of the work, there was a lot of energy behind audits. I mean, I think there were like several audits that had occurred. There were like audits of the audits. And we're like, well, what about the kids? What are we doing for the community? We were very happy that Cole had stepped up to address this birthing moms pilot that needed to happen. That got stalled because of COVID, but that is still going to happen. So just, you know, that supporting the community, being able to be more collaborative instead of the health department just serving as a regulatory body, but really looking at, okay, what are some things we can do to really help our kids and our families that are hurting most? Looking at landlords' responsibility for covering abatement and not always using city funds to do that. We also know that there needs to be a strategic plan for the city, how we're going to eradicate lead from our environment. And that's including all sources of lead poisoning, paint, soil, and water. That is something that is in the works. It got again stalled because of COVID, but that's something that's going to happen. The LED program, the staffing, has been through a lot. You know, they've been traumatized. We have some new staff on board, new management. So the team is moving along. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done because the LED program has a variety of funding sources. So making sure there's compliance across all those funding sources. We got the HUD money again, which was great. But just even this being able to bill Medicaid for lead poisoning services. I mean, just other ways for us to sustain the lead program. I do feel more confident that the program is headed in the right direction, but there still needs to be some adjustments to salaries, for instance. The lead risk assessors, they need to make more money to incorporate the more technical aspects of their job. So that's being addressed right now. Also the technology, like the tools that they use for their job. Also, like we were looking at the collection of water samples in addition to the paint to be able to see if we are seeing any high lead and water levels at these properties. If you're not collecting, you can't say it with full confidence that you are or not. So just things like that, little adjustments in how we function as a program to really help guide the work that needs to be done. So I am happy that there's been improvements, but again, that work needs to be carried on.
You've touched on this, but during a Board of Health meeting earlier this month, a member of your team reported that the health department is well positioned to carry out the lead program efficiently and effectively, but with adequate staffing. So a number of positions are vacant. Is that correct? And can that be addressed, or is it a funding or a finding the staff and training them issue?
Yeah, it's a combination of the two. There's a certain skill set that's needed for that work. So, you know, there's a pipeline issue too. We want to make sure that we're creating, building up that profession, making sure that it's diverse, that people that are moving into these positions are from the community and that they have the ability to give back. So how do you even become, you know, a public health employee or health department employee? So I think there needs to be some additional efforts to look at pipeline programs to get more people into these lines of work, especially the environmental, the more technical types of positions. But again, it's marketing what's available and really reaching out and helping people get what they need to be able to move into these technical positions.
Back to the department as a whole, you know, what are the components of its workings, of its programs, that are in greatest need of attention or improvement when you look across the spectrum of what the team is asked to handle?
Oh, absolutely. So the health department, when I came in, there were a lot of vacancies. I'm leaving. There's, you know, I would say the vacancies aren't as intense as when I started. That's because we have all of this additional money from the CARES Act to fill positions specific to COVID-19. But there's still areas that need care as far as hiring is concerned. We finally have a full HR team now, so that's going to be a big help getting people through the hiring process, getting people onboarded, making sure that they're supported in their lines of work. Having a full leadership team now, having deputy commissioners, is really important because they are more operational in nature and they provide sustainability to the programs and services that fall in their wheelhouses. For instance, environmental health is Deputy Claire Evers, and then under her is the lead program and the food inspection program and public health emergency preparedness, having very strong management in those areas. And then, of course, being able to support the staff that are in the field or working remotely that are doing the work. So that's just an example of some of the improvements that have been made. But again, the health department's recruitment process and getting people through, that there's still opportunities for improvement to get people through more quickly. But we also want to make sure we're doing things the right way so we're not bringing people on that haven't been vetted. We want to make sure, you know, the clearance is where it needs to be. And verifying education and training and all of that too.
Again, back to that same Board of Health meeting, when you were speaking to the board, you said that the internal public health department leadership team, and you've just referred to that, I think, is equipped to carry the department through this interim period when you are gone and the next person is not hired. So what makes you so confident that that's the case?
Oh, so part of the reason in selecting them as deputy commissioners and a chief of staff is based off their skill set. I had this vision of what we needed, and I was very intentional about putting the pieces together to create this solid core of support. I'm a Gen Xer, so I like to use Voltron as an example of what this team is like. So they're pretty much these lions that come together to form the Voltron robot. So, but they all have different skills, and they mesh well together and provide support. There is going to be one deputy that will serve as an interim commissioner. So who is that person? It is our community health deputy commissioner, so Marlena Jackson.
And how long has she been with you or with the team?
Oh, she's a newer recruit, but she has many years of senior level management experience. So she started in April, and then she came from Frederick Hospital. So we have someone that has the experience, someone from the community, and has a great, she has done a great job building that team out. So they can continue to function while she moves into the commissioner role. And of course, I will continue to provide support during this transition until a permanent commissioner is assigned. We definitely had this in mind that we wanted to create a bench or backup to the commissioner's office because that didn't happen in the past. Legally, we couldn't even do it until May of 2018. The council had to create an ordinance to support having a special deputy commissioner. So all of these things, again, that no one thought about until the vacancy occurred, and then there's like, wait, what? There's no one around to make decisions on behalf of the commissioner unless the commissioner is present. So, I mean, we're in a better place. Definitely more work that needs to happen, but we're in a better place.
So now, while I can still call you Commissioner Kowalik, I will ask, do you want to share any final reflections about being here, the contribution, the importance of public health here and everywhere?
Sure. So final thoughts. Again, it's been a very bittersweet experience. I'm from Milwaukee, Sherman Park. You know, I came back because of this vacancy that was created due to mismanagement of the lead program. So definitely that was one of my priorities. Just knowing that the department is in a better place than it was in when I inherited it in 2018 gives me some comfort, but I also know that there's a solid leadership team in place now that will continue to support the mission and the vision of the health department, the living your best life Milwaukee, and we're in a pandemic that's going to be around for a while, you know, and how can we do that in a safe way? So just reinforcing the messages about prevention of COVID-19 through mask wearing, hand washing or sanitizing, distancing 6 feet. We're concerned about the wintertime, obviously, about the indoors versus the outdoors. And what can be done to help prevent the spread of COVID-19 the more and more we learn about this virus? So I know everyone's on pins and needles about a vaccine. We're not going to promote a vaccine that's not safe. We want to make sure the vaccine goes through the FDA trials, just like any other medication. And then also, this, you know, being able to come back to the place where I started my career is very rewarding. You know, I went through a lot of unnecessary drama and sacrificed a lot, but I wouldn't have had it any other way. So I'm, again, grateful for the opportunity to come back to my hometown to serve in this capacity. It's been 2 years, it feels like 20. But I'm grateful for the opportunity. And I just, again, want to encourage people too. I know a lot of people are suffering and have lost hope at this point because of what's happening with this pandemic. And I just want to encourage people to really reflect on what is it that's causing you the most concern. Maybe it is your job. Maybe your job is stressing you out. Maybe the environment's very toxic. Make a plan to get out of that situation. It's not worth your health being compromised or losing your family or damaging relationships that you care about. So thank you.
Jeanette Kowalik is the outgoing City of Milwaukee Commissioner of Health. She held the position for 2 years and left the job this week. She spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz. Coming up next, we look at the history of public mental health care and why it often falls on the criminal justice system. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There has been an ongoing conversation about mental health care in the U.S. After tragedies like the school shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary or Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, some political actors are quick to blame mental health issues. But despite these political talking points, public funding for mental health care has plummeted over the past few decades. And the history of mental health care in this country is fraught with mismanagement and abuse, often made worse by a lack of funding. Zeb Larson is a historian whose work has looked at the history of public mental health care in the U.S., and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
How long have there been public institutions in the United States that deal with mental health?
Well, that's a really interesting question there, Joy. When this country is created, formally, mental health care at a public level is extremely weak. In fact, it's mostly delivered through jails, you know, sort of informally providing care basically for people who live there long term. And it's private institutions that initially provide much of this service. In fact, it's Quaker institutions, first in Philadelphia, who I think opened one of the very first such hospitals in the United States. And these are what are referred to as asylums. They start to expand more as you get into the 1840s and 1850s, and that happens for a few reasons. Much of that is simply the growth of a large urban population. Cities, when the United States is first founded, they're pretty small, especially compared to anything you might find in Europe. But by the time you get to the 1840s and 1850s, you have these increasingly large cities, and these also, it's not yet quite urban exactly, but urbanizing population where it's not necessarily feasible to have a family care long-term for an ill individual, so they start to get moved into hospitals. And this is where you see the slow birth of a hospital system in the United States.
So when we move into these hospitals, what does care start to look like there? Because it's my understanding that for a lot of our history, mental illness itself was looked at very differently.
That's a really excellent point. And it is, I think you could say it's in many ways dramatically different from what we would expect today, for that matter. There's a great deal of focus in the 19th century, particularly, on trying to find permanent cures through what eventually they're going to call mental hygiene. That's a term that evolves later. But what it looks like in the 1840s and 1850s, as this sort of professionalizes, is this idea that you could rehabilitate people suffering from certain forms of mental illness by putting them in healthier surroundings. This almost invariably means taking them out of cities and moving them to the country, putting them to work at certain forms of rehabilitating work, so farming. This is actually why most mental hospitals in the United States, into the 1960s in many cases, actually had large working farms on them. Part of it was so that they could be self-sustaining and require well, frankly, smaller budget appropriations from state governments. But it was also so, in many cases, they could put the people who worked there or lived there to some kind of work. And that's what ends up happening. So treatment is this kind of moral treatment that tries to restore people to what doctors perceive as sort of mental health. And that really sort of means making them productive. And then they can go back out and, in many cases, go back to what they had been previously doing before.
So when does mental health care, in the way that we view it today, when does that really start to emerge?
Well, there's a storied history to that one. See, I have to use that particular term for it. So this focus on sort of moral treatment and rehabilitation, it doesn't really work the way that doctors want it to. For one thing, a lot of forms of mental illness, they just don't respond to it that way. We know this now. So what happens over the course of the 19th century is that more and more people start to go into these hospitals. And these hospitals had always been founded with the assumption that people will get better, they will leave, we will take in new patients, cure them. But that's not really how it works for a lot of people. In many cases, they're chronically ill, especially with the kinds of treatments that are open to people in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So the hospital populations just swell. They keep getting bigger to the point that they far really outgrow what they had ever been intended to sort of house. And then at a certain point, doctors begin looking for new kinds of treatments to get away from the, what they call the warehousing of patients. And there are several treatments they arrive at that are really unsuccessful, but they embrace for a time because it seems doing something is better than doing nothing. And then beginning in the 1940s and early 1950s, we arrive at the development of actual antipsychotic drugs and antidepressants. And once those enter the picture, this is really transformative for these institutions because doctors are able to prescribe treatments that for many people dramatically improve their symptoms, sometimes at the cost of certain side effects, sometimes only for periods of time. But compared to the tools that had been available to them previously, they're more effective by a whole order of magnitude.
Now, at this point, it seems like we enter a very interesting part of this history. And I'm interested to know, you know, alongside this treatment, this medical treatment for mental health, what were the political perspectives on these kinds of institutions, especially as we look at public health institutions?
You know, these institutions in the early to mid 19th century, they were embraced a little bit more positively, to the point that actually there was a bill that went up in front of Congress in the 1850s that actually would have used government owned land to actually fund a series of federal mental health asylums. It doesn't get passed. Franklin Pierce vetoes it, as I recall, and then that's sort of the end of the word on federal involvement. Then it falls to the states. And what it becomes for the states is an increasingly an expensive item that they have to allocate money to year after year and face rather sharp growth over, especially because the U.S. population ages a lot in this period compared to previous history. So politically, up to the 1930s, 1940s, you mostly see both parties doing anything that they can to try to get people out of hospitals. It's in the wake of World War II that you see Democrats especially, but in many cases Republicans, I'm thinking of some Western states here as well, that they look to the federal government as a new tool to drive mental health care. They see, and this is where you see Truman, for example, in 1946, pass the Federal Mental Health Act that creates the National Institute of Mental Health. You don't see immediately them stepping in and providing more money for the hospitals and the asylums, but there's this increasing role that the federal government comes to play, and that it continues until the mid-1960s, at which point you have President Kennedy create, this was actually, I think, the last law that he signs before he's assassinated in November of 1963, creating community mental health centers that will be administered by the federal government. So that's sort of, as quickly as I can, about a century's worth of political evolution on the topic.
Well, and as we move forward from the 1960s, I mean, as you mentioned, of course, we start to get drugs, antipsychotic drugs, that are able to treat people in a way that they don't have to be institutionalized. We also, of course, have, you know, earlier in the 20th century, the reports of real mistreatment at a lot of these institutions that cause a lot of, you know, public uproar against them. As we move into an era of that seems like the prevailing thought is deinstitutionalizing people, removing them from these places of care, how does that impact the funding for these kinds of mental health facilities?
Well, that's a great question. That actually, I mean, in some ways touches most closely on my own interest in this topic, is that in many cases, there were a lot of people, and really on both sides of the political aisle in this country, who thought that these new drugs, chlorpromazine, for example, that they would in some ways enable them to get rid of the hospital system entirely. There were sort of, and from the perspective of somebody living in 2020, they seem wildly optimistic. These projections that mental illness itself could entirely be cured because of these drugs. So in many cases, and this is true of some of the federal blue ribbon panels that are created in the 1950s to study this issue, there is this expectation that with enough money basically going to drug treatment, they'll just be able to close the hospitals almost entirely. And this is where you start to run up against some of the science of it, because while there are large numbers of people who respond very effectively to medications, they also run up against some people whose symptoms are more treatment resistant, who might require greater social safety net supports. So as you get into the 1960s and 1970s, you start to see more difficult discharges of people, people who require more support than is actually available to them in order to live effectively in the community, which in turn means that more resources get shifted away from hospitals to support those individuals, but then the hospitals themselves continue to suffer in quality. This is why you see throughout the 1960s and onward a number of scandals and revelations that come out about the way people are treated in many of the hospitals, patient neglect, for example.
Well, and a figure who you point out, especially in the federal government, is President Ronald Reagan and his 1981 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Bill. Can you unpack that a bit and how it impacted state community mental health centers?
So what Reagan does with the 1980 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Bill, boy, that title is just a mouthful, isn't it? But what it does is it alters a funding scheme that had been relatively stable from Kennedy in 1963 to Reagan in 1980, in which the federal government provided X amount of money to these community mental health centers, and the expectation was that states would match the funds, and it was sort of a complicated funding scheme. And Reagan changes the funding structure very dramatically. First, there are dramatic cuts made in this period, and then the remainder of the money is, in many cases, allocated back to the states as block grants, meaning that they can do with those funds what they wish to do, which means in many cases they're not going to use it to use for mental health treatment, but they might use it to plug a different hole in the budget. So what you start to see then is this reduced level of federal commitment. And this, in turn, forces a number of hospitals to close. I do like to sort of put a cautionary note on describing too much of this to Reagan, because I think that in many ways what Reagan did in 1980 was sort of the culminating logic of this idea of deinstitutionalization, that we have more effective treatment mechanisms in the community, and in many cases, to be clear, they are more effective, so that we can just kind of keep getting rid of the hospitals. That is sort of the end point of this logic. That is, incidentally, what he did as governor in California through the 1960s. So his actions as president, I don't think they're unique. Let me put it that way.
The idea being that even if Reagan hadn't been president, it's likely that another president would have passed something similar.
Indeed. And in many cases, a lot of the forces that are unleashed because of that, they're already sort of in play at the state level. That's where mental health care in this country is just so tricky, is that it's such a complicated interplay now between the federal government and the state government, because it's money coming from both sides. So it's very rarely just a monocausal thing.
Well, and to look at just the last few decades since that was passed and since, you know, we've seen a lot of mental health facilities close in cities around the country. What has been the impact of defunding, not just at the federal level, but also at the state level, for these kinds of institutions?
Well, the institutions themselves, I mean, the hospitals have really become what they call forensic institutions. And by that, I mean, they really only cater to individuals who have committed a crime of some kind or might be dangerous, and so they get sentenced there. I'm thinking about my home state, Oregon. In Oregon, the Oregon State Hospital is almost exclusively for people who have committed a crime but been found not guilty by reason of insanity. There are some individuals who get sent there to stabilize while awaiting trial, but that really is it. Oregon State Hospital overwhelmingly exists for that purpose. And the other state hospitals, Eastern Oregon State, for example, they've closed. So increasingly the focus is individuals will be treated only in communities at this sort of decentralized level. And how that, I think, plays out is then people are sort of at the whim of what the county and the state is willing to supply them, which means that even within a state, you get, I think it's safe to say, pretty wildly divergent outcomes in terms of access, in terms of how many people there are, in terms of the resources. And then, of course, whatever the economic situation is at the moment.
Well, and of course, now we're talking about people who frequently in conversations would be labeled as criminals. And so when we're talking about giving funds to people who can be labeled as criminals, it becomes a little bit more complicated on a political level.
It does, and this is also where it dovetails with, in many ways, mental illness has been recriminalized in this country. Remember, I said at the beginning of this that in the 1780s, 1790s, people were frequently treated in jails. We're back to that. The three largest mental health providers in the United States are Rikers Island, Los Angeles County Jail, and the Cook County Jail. This is overwhelmingly where people receive treatment. That's actually true at a smaller city level as well. So this is where, the mental health system just gets very complicated in this country.
Well, and to kind of sum it up, how would you describe where our mental health system is today, specifically our public mental health system, at a time when we're talking more and more about mental health for a variety of reasons, for often criminal reasons, but different socioeconomic outcomes that we'd like to change?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm a historian, so the closer I get to the present, the more uncomfortable I become in some ways. But I will say, what we've seen is, on the one hand, tremendous improvements in some ways. There is so much better understanding of mental health than there was 100 years ago. And increasingly, what they call the consumer perspective, which is to say the person who receives treatment, they are actually given a voice in a way that they would not have been 100 years ago. And I will just go to my grave maintaining that that is a tremendous historical justice that we've managed to write. However, what we've also exposed is that increasingly access to quality public mental health care in many ways depends on socioeconomic factors, which means there are a great many people who end up on the losing line of that. And that is something that we have not really rectified in this country. And to be honest, I think when people set out on deinstitutionalization, I'm not really sure that they were thinking through exactly how complicated this question was going to become.
Yeah. Well, Zeb, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me.
Zeb Larson is a historian whose work has looked at the history of mental health care and treatment in the United States. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. We'll take one more break and then learn about plans for the Milwaukee Public Museum and Betty Brin's Children Museum to share a new and larger shared space in the future. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In 2018, the Milwaukee Public Museum announced its plans to build and move to a new facility. The current space MPM has occupied for more than 50 years can no longer meet the needs for storage and exhibits. Betty Brin Children's Museum also has a similar problem. They've been in a space right on the lakefront since 1995 that was never meant to be a museum. This month, both museums' board of directors agreed to create an alliance between the Milwaukee Public Museum and Betty Brin's to co-locate under the same new roof. To find out more about this recent agreement, I'm joined by Betty Brin Executive Director Brian King and Milwaukee Public Museum President and CEO Dr. Ellen Senske. Senske begins by explaining the groundwork.
Yeah, it's actually been in the works for quite a while, though the really intense part of negotiations took place all during COVID-19. But it's something that we've been, as this community knows, on a quest for a new building. And Betty Brin is also looking for new space, or will be in the future. And so it just made sense to sit down and discuss whether this was a good thing for both institutions.
And both institutions right now have very unique locations, especially Brian, where you're at Betty Brin, right at the lakefront in a unique space as well. So when it came to deciding to co-locate with the Milwaukee Public Museum, already kind of looking into this and what their needs are, does having Betty Brin Museum in the works of this now significantly alter the needs the new space will have to meet?
Well, I don't know that it's a significant alteration. You know, when you're already building a relatively significant structure, adding on what would be necessary for our museum is definitely added size and cost, but there are economies of scale once a project's already in motion. So, and for us, we're very excited about this opportunity because while we do have a unique location, beautiful location here on the lakefront, we're in a space that was never designed to be a children's museum. That's really smaller than we would like it to be. It has an odd layout, and to be able to design from scratch is extremely exciting for us as it is for the public museum.
And outside of just the new possibilities, how would this new location benefit both the Betty Brin and Milwaukee Public Museum, you know, more so from a logistic and a business standpoint? I imagine it's easier to run two places under one roof and consolidate some of the things that commonly ail budgets.
Yeah, I think that those are all the things that we've yet to determine. So what we've determined is that we want to be under one roof, that we think it's really the right thing to do for the community. It enhances both of us to be able to have people walk into one space that has two separate offerings. But we're still early in this process, and we've yet to determine what that means in terms of us being both in the same space.
Overall, do you think it'll just help the longevity of both institutions at a basic level?
I think so. Yeah, I think that this is very good for both institutions down the road. And, you know, we found in our conversations that we have points of intersection that make this, you know, potential synergies that make this really an attractive concept for us to be under the same roof as two separate museums. And we think that will pay dividends down the road.
What would you say to people who may commonly think at first that museums are each other's competition?
We don't view it as competition. We view it as the ability to collaborate, to bring in more people, to, you know, to share, to co-equally share the resources. And so we think that this being under one roof just gives people so many more options. You know, families aren't all one age. Families have kids that can range from 2 to 10. And so that allows families to come in and be able to partake in both institutions and have a great time in this one campus.
And from the beginning, when Ellen and I first met and started talking, it was clear that we both believed that what's good for cultural institutions in Milwaukee is good for cultural institutions in Milwaukee. And we see this not in terms of competition, but we come from a place where building up any one cultural institution is just good for us. It's good for us all.
So being a Milwaukee native, I've enjoyed both museums throughout my life. And Brian, I'm seeing you. You're at Betty Brin right now over Zoom. And, you know, it's before pandemic, but I took my nieces and nephews there with the whole family. And same thing with the public museum. So what are some signature spaces that people have always associated with your organizations and enjoyed that, you know, given that the details aren't ironed out yet, but that you plan to rehome successfully at the new space? Because you're kind of having to balance nostalgia with the modern tools and needs that you'll have access to in creating a space.
I guess I would say that for the Milwaukee Public Museum, there is nothing that will go over intact because the amount of space will be less space for us for the exhibits. But what we are bringing over will be reimagined to make it much more modern because we're developing an exhibit not for this generation, but for future generations. And so we have to look to what do future generations need and want. And so this will be reimagined, and you will, I hope when you walk in, you'll say, oh, I remember that, but maybe not exactly that. You know, what I like to say about MPM is throughout our time, and this home will not be our second home, it will be our fourth home. So we have moved before and we have successfully moved before. What we have shown is that each step when we move into a new place, we've been cutting edge and look to the future, not to the past. We use the past to inform that future, but we've looked to see what is the need in the future for the museum. So I think that people will be excited and surprised by how we will be reimagining.
We're looking forward to creating a space that is modular, that can be reinvented as the world goes and you want to try out some new concepts. But that being said, a lot of what we do at its core doesn't necessarily change, because we are all about inspiring children to wonder and explore their world through play and innovative hands-on learning experiences. And that we will bring to the new museum, and things like our hometown, which is one of the most iconic parts of our museum, which is a miniaturized Milwaukee community in many ways, where roles get reversed. Kids are in charge, they do the shopping, they fix the car, they deliver the mail. Some version of that for sure is coming with us.
And Ellen, with the museum, you know, a lot we don't see is in storage. And I know there's a need for new spaces, being able to share and rotate what's in storage. How are you imagining that is helping to shape the new modern exhibits that you want to do?
So first of all, I want to say, when we say storage, we need to understand that our collections, the bulk of them are not in storage. They're actually research collections that are being utilized by our own researchers and researchers across the world. That is actually about 3.2 million of the 4 million objects are research collections that we would not put on display, because the value is in what they help us to understand about the world that we live in. The other collections, I should say, are also our anthropology collections, which then we add another 300,000 or so to that. They really are also research collections too, and actively used. So the way we will be operating with the collections is, those that can be changed out, we will be changing out. But we also, the big key thing for this new future museum is to really, what I say is, turn the museum inside out, which is to make that research and those collections much more obvious to the public. So if you ask me, how are we going to do that? We don't have that exactly worked out yet, but it's really to make people much more engaged with what's going on behind the scenes than they are able to do right now.
And Brian, as you mentioned, it's the hands-on learning for younger children. What are you most excited about in being able to kind of reimagine and not be limited to the space you currently hold?
I'm most excited about having a bit more freedom to design experiences that are not as space limited, that can unleash kids a little bit. It's a little hard for us to do that right now. And we're also hoping that there'll be some verticality that we can work with a little bit more, because one of the really fun things to do in children's museums is to create an environment where kids feel the urge to take smart risks, because that's where a lot of their sense of self gets developed. And they're obviously safe risks in a children's museum, but they don't necessarily appear that way to a four-year-old or five-year-old. And having a bit more space to design that experience is really exciting for us.
So the agreement has been made. What are the next steps and your approximate timeline? Obviously, so much is unknown right now, but what are you generally moving towards right now?
So we will be, over the next 6 months, really defining what does this really look like and getting into the nitty-gritty of that. And we won't be heading into design in terms of a building until sometime, hopefully, in the next year. So we are still in those early stages of getting everything lined up, but it is moving along. But we, even in the best case scenario, we will not be opening this new building until 25, 26. And that's with everything going right, because these are complicated projects to pull together, because it's not just building a building, but it's also putting inside that building what is our mission and making sure that that's done right. So in the short term, it's getting this really solidified so we really know what it is, and then continuing to work towards that, being under that one roof.
And Brian, anything for you to add to that?
I would add that the timing of all of this does afford us some interesting opportunities. And we're in these relatively early stages in the midst of a global pandemic. It's entirely possible that it's not the last one that we'll ever experience. And we will be designing and building a museum with a lot better information and with a lot more attention to design for what a museum of the future should look like, particularly if we have to take some pandemic type things into consideration. And our timeline allows us to really to benefit from that, from the architects and the designers and the collective hive out there as it generates new ideas. So I think that's really beneficial to both of our organizations down the road. And I'm excited to be able to do that. It's not like we were fully, three quarters designed and then had to say, wait a minute, let's pump the brakes and rethink things because of this thing called COVID.
Well, it's certainly an exciting development, and myself and I'm sure many, many Milwaukeeans are going to look forward to the new space to come. So Dr. Ellen Zensky and Brian King, thank you both for joining me today and telling us more about it.
Thank you.
Brian King is the executive director of the Betty Brin Children's Museum, and Dr. Ellen Zensky is the president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.